And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to do our commentary as we do every week, at least almost every week. And I'd like to say that we have some new commentaries from that famous commentarist, Oak. And this week's commentary is...
Big Oil's Little Tea Party. I'm assuming most of you folks aren't surprised that a room full of executives from Big Oil fabricated the national energy policy that the present occupant of the White House foisted on the U.S. public late this past spring. After all, Dick Cheney, who headed the task force, and George W., the man allegedly in charge, are all about fossil fuels. As director of Harkin Energy Corp., the son of oil man, former CIA director, and former U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush, George Jr. has made a tidy profit over the years in the oil business, even with failed but somehow profitable ventures and questions of SEC insider trading violations. In fact, the Bush family's government connections and their oil business profits place them on what might be termed the shaky dome of a teapot, pretty near the boiling point. Vice President Dick Cheney's tenure as CEO of big-time oil equipment supplier Halliburton, Inc., the fifth-largest military contractor in the U.S., puts the Veep squarely in bed with Big Oil. Cheney scored a $34 million retirement package from Halliburton, a company that does business with some, if not all, of the worst dictatorial regimes on the planet. Halliburton's list of customers reads like an Amnesty International roster of chronic human rights violators, not to mention destroyers of the biosphere and all-around enemies of the Earth. Interestingly, Halliburton contracted with Iraq to rebuild its oil infrastructure after Bush Sr.'s Gulf War destroyed it. But NGOs that don't earn a dime in commerce can't even send Clorox to Iraqi hospitals. So, you tell me, does Big Oil have a seat at the table in the White House? Seat? They've got nearly the whole table. It looks like everyone else is in the kitchen, eating with the help. Now, the government accounting office wants to see the guest list for Cheney's little tea party on the energy policy. But the Veep and his lawyers are digging in their feet. Representatives Henry Waxman of California and John Dingell of Michigan are also concerned about undue influence from Bush campaign contributors like Enron Corporation CEO Kenneth Lay and energy industry promoters like the Edison Institute. It's a pretty safe bet that reduced energy consumption, solar panels, wind turbines, things of that nature, were not items up for much, if any, discussion with those players at the table. It's said that not one environmentalist was in attendance. I'm not sure how much more blatant a conflict of interest can get. While government watchdogs and media lapdogs search more or less for a smoking gun, the rest of us can pretty clearly see through the thinly veiled smokescreen. Big Oil, of course in company with Big Auto, the nuke boosters, and Old King Coal, is dug in at the head of the table of present U.S. energy policy. It will be more than interesting to see if their little tea party is crashed by any number of disgruntled outsiders. However, like all such affairs, at some point the party's over. At least that's how this Oak sees it for Earth First Radio.
And that commentary by Oak is his latest effort. And of course we'll have more commentary by Oak next week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz on Earth First Radio. Let's move right on into environmental news. More genetically modified crops have been trashed in France. Activists opposed to genetically modified food have struck again in France, tearing up three plots of land where bioengineered corn was being grown on a test basis, industry groups said. Seed and Plant Protection Industry Organization said they were shocked after the activists destroyed the genetically modified maize tests in the Drôme department of southeast France. The group calling itself Limes a Grain, a play on the name of French seed company Limagrain, claimed responsibility for the attack that took place on Friday night. The plant organization said it was at least the third such incident since late June, when the farm industry was forced to publish the list of districts in France where genetically modified crops are being tested. Philippe Gracien, head of the French seed professional group GNIS, said he expected further attacks. Gracien said he feared the left-wing Confédération Paysanne Farmers Union, which has targeted GM crops in the past, was planning a new push to destroy test fields. Unfortunately, when one listens to the speeches of the Confédération Paysanne leaders, it's hard to remain calm, Gracien told Reuters. José Bové, the fiery founder of the Confédération Paysanne, demanded on Saturday a complete ban on GM crops in France and threatened to begin uprooting test fields across the country if the government did not intervene. In March, French court gave Bové a 10-month suspended jail sentence and 2 years probation for destroying genetically modified rice plants at a research institute in June of 1999. 2 months earlier, Bové and other anti-globalization activists helped uproot some 3 hectares of genetically modified soybeans at an experimental farm in Brazil, operated by American life sciences firm Monsanto. And that news from Reuters News Service. And moving to Thailand, Thailand counts the cost of devastating flash floods. Flash floods that swept through 3 remote Thai villages, killing dozens of people on the weekend, have caused 39 million baht, or about $869,000 in damage, government officials said. The official death toll from the floods in Phetchabun province was 74, and there are 97 people still listed as missing. Officials said 160 houses were destroyed and 194 damaged, but rescue teams were hopeful of finding more survivors, they said. The area hit is very large, and it's very difficult to get into some of the victims because of the mud and trees. The flash flood swept everything away, said Wathira Chotira Sarani, an official of the Interior Ministry's Civil Defense Secretariat. But many people managed to grab onto bamboo trees and coconut trees, and they could save themselves, Wathira told Reuters. Wathira said the army was building shelters for the homeless, and local charities were sending supplies of food, drink, and clothing. No international appeal for help was necessary, he said. And here's the kicker. Authorities have blamed the ferocity of the flood on deforestation in the mountainous region. Tropical storm Usagi, which swept over Thailand before fizzling out, was causing flooding in 22 of Thailand's 76 provinces. And we thank Reuters News Service for that story. And the Bush administration is refusing to abide by a legal agreement to protect designated critical habitat areas for the endangered Santa Ana sucker in Southern California. The Center for Biological Diversity, the American Fisheries Society, California Trout, and Friends of the River notified the administration that if it does not immediately protect the sucker habitat, they will ask a federal judge to find it in contempt of court. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service settled a lawsuit in November of last year by agreeing to map out and protect critical habitat areas for the Santa Ana sucker by January of this year. But the Bush administration has squelched progress on the protections. The Santa Ana sucker was once one of the most common fish in lower elevation Los Angeles Basin rivers and streams. The species is now absent from 75% of its historical range as a result of urbanization and water pollution, and is now limited to short stretches of the Santa Clara, San Gabriel, and Santa Ana rivers and Big Tahunga Creek. Because the sucker requires clean water to survive, the species serves as a prime indicator of water quality in Southern California rivers and streams. And a massive California timber sale has been stopped for now. The Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club, the California Wilderness Coalition, the Klamath Forest Alliance, the Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center, and the Forest Conservation Council have won a temporary restraining order on July 11th, blocking a massive timber sale within the roadless area bordering the Trinity Alps Wilderness. The Big Bar timber sale is the first planned in a California roadless area since the Clinton administration released its roadless area conservation plan in January. The plan would have logged 1,050 acres in the Six Rivers National Forest to produce 20 million board feet of timber. Though the timber sale would harm northern goshawk, Pacific fishers, salmon, and steelhead trout, the Forest Service did not take any steps to protect those endangered species. And let's move back to animal news here. A mysterious affliction is affecting eagles. A mysterious disease that causes disorientation, motor problems, and eventually death has been found in bald eagles, coots, geese, great horned owls, and killdeer in 11 different lakes in Arkansas, Georgia, and the Carolinas, according to ABC News. Although only 16 bald eagles have died from the disease this year, biologists are worried that it is occurring on a more widespread basis than we realize. Scientists have been unable to identify the cause of the disease and believe it is caused by an outside agent, though not a virus or a bacterium. And the Colorado River Delta clam has been found to be a distinct species. Scientists have confirmed that a clam found at the mouth of the Colorado River in Mexico exists nowhere else in the world and is close to extinction because of drastically reduced flows into its delta estuary habitat, said ESC sources. The scientific report released by the Center for Biological Diversity and Defenders of Wildlife provides strong evidence on the need to protect the species under the Endangered Species Act. Once so abundant that whole islands and beaches were made up of its shells, U.S. dams and water diversions have caused the clam to decline to the point where only one tiny population is known to remain. And a judge orders butterfly listing action. A federal judge has given the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 30 days to make a listing decision on the Sacramento checker spot butterfly, an imperiled species found only in New Mexico, says Associated Press. The judge rejected the agency's claim that it did not have the money to proceed with the listing, noting that its financial predicament may be in part of the product of its own making, since it admitted in the 2001 Interior Appropriations Bill that the listing program has not proposed at a level that would allow the service to meet all of the Endangered Species Act's requirements and deadlines. And sudden oak death has been found in isolated Oregon forests. The elusive tree killer known as sudden oak death has crossed the state line into Oregon, making a mockery of feverish efforts on both sides of the border to prevent such an occurrence. The microscopic invader was identified in two patches of tan oak trees deep in the woodlands in southwest corner of Oakland, just north of Brookings, Oregon. The discovery has left forestry experts in a quandary because the infected areas are far from any roadways or developed areas. The pathogen previously had been confined only as far north as Mendocino County, and nobody can figure out how it made it all the way to Oregon, especially if it didn't hitch a ride with a human. These are patches out in the boonies, said Dan Hilburn, an administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. That tells you this disease is capable of spreading in ways we do not know about. Sudden oak death has killed tens of thousands of coastal live oak, black oak, tan oak trees in 8 counties along the California coastline. It has been identified as Phytophthora, a kind of brown algae that takes many different forms, one of which caused the Irish potato famine in the mid-1800s. This particular organism has also been found in the California buckeye, Shreve's oak, huckleberry, rhododendron, madrone, arrowwood, and California bay laurel trees. Forest pathologists believe the microbe spreads from the other host to the oak trees, which then die quickly. Forestry experts have speculated that hikers and mountain bikers are spreading the disease by transferring infected particles from one place to another on their boots or tires, but it is also known that the Phytophthora spores can become airborne on their own. Quarantines in California and Oregon have restricted the movement of oak and plant products, including firewood, that carry the disease. In Oregon, where the foggy coastal climate is believed to be a perfect breeding ground for the deadly spores, officials started a wide-reaching public awareness campaign in an attempt to keep the disease out of the state. But it was all for naught. Hilburn said the infected sites were found during an aerial survey of the forest, nowhere near a roadway or a trail where a mountain biker, let alone a firewood salesman, might be expected to visit. It's a pain in the neck, said Hilburn, who met with state regulators yesterday in an effort to come up with an eradication campaign. We have a coast and a fog belt just like you do in Northern California, so it's not a surprise that it got here, but it got here more quickly than we thought it would. Now it's going to strain our budgets. And kill your trees, by the way. Experts studying the disease were at a loss to explain the long distance between the infestations in the two states. It's kind of odd, says forest pathologist Matteo Garbellato, who knows more than anyone about the pathogen. It's not uniformly distributed. A likely explanation would be that humans are involved in transporting it, but we really don't know. Garbellato said the federal government will now have to get more involved in funding research if the mystery is ever going to be resolved. This is not simply a state problem. A much larger area is now at risk, Garbellato said. The discovery in Oregon brings the problem to a whole different level. And the story was by Peter Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle. And orca declines are warranting a federal review. The National Marine Fisheries Service plans to study the reasons behind a decline in the number of killer whales that congregate in Washington State's Puget Sound in the Strait of Juan de Fuca in the summertime. The agency will begin a formal status review on the Conservation Coalition request to provide the whales with Endangered Species Act protection. The review is the first in a series of steps that could lead to Endangered Species Act protection by mid-2003. We take very seriously the recent declines in killer whale populations and are determined to find out what's causing it, said Donna Darm, the acting head of NMFS's Northwest Regional Office in Seattle. Accepting this petition to conduct the review is an important first step in determining the appropriate course of action. National Marine Fisheries Service said it would convene a biological review team of killer whale experts to try and find out if these whales constitute a distinct population segment as defined by the ESA, why the whale's population is declining, and to make a recommendation about whether the agency should propose an ESA listing next May. The Northwest's familiar black and white killer whales, also called orcas, are known as the Eastern North Pacific Southern Resident Stock of killer whales to distinguish them from other killer whale groups. They spend their summers in Washington's Puget Sound and the Strait of Juan de Fuca and the nearby Strait of Georgia in British Columbia, where they are a frequent object of photographers and whale-watching cruises in the area. The southern resident population has always been small, according to National Marine Fisheries Service biologists, but it has fluctuated since record-keeping started in the 1970s, going from a low of around 70 to a peak of about 97 in 1996. The population is now estimated to be 78 animals. We know so little about these animals outside their summer foraging areas, said Brent Norberg, NMFS biologist. We don't even know where they spend the winter or the extent of their range. That makes determining the reason for the decline quite a challenge. If you'd like more information and if you'd like to see a copy of the petition, it's available at www.nwr.noaa.gov. That's www.nwr.noaa.gov. And we thank the Environment News Service for that story. And birds and salmon both win in a Columbia River case. A federal judge has ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to complete a comprehensive environmental impact statement before any more government funds are spent hazing Caspian terns or cormorants and destroying their habitat on the Columbia River estuary. In her 18-page order, Judge Rothstein also found the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service erred in granting a permit under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act for taking birds without an EIS. Conservationists have been asking federal and state officials for such an EIS for the last 3 years. Noting that there was no sound science to link Caspian terns to salmon declines or to impending salmon recovery, conservationists emphasized the need to concentrate on other factors including hydropower, habitat harvests, and fish hatcheries, known together as the four H's. This is a significant victory for sound science, birds, and salmon, said John Flicker, president and CEO of the National Audubon Society. We were disappointed that we ultimately needed to sue the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Army Corps of Engineers, but the end result is what the law required. No action can be taken until we understand how the birds and salmon interact and how they will be affected by the Corps' proposed action. The plan to dislocate the largest Caspian tern colony was initiated by federal and state agencies In response to the Tern's consumption of salmon and related fish, more than 90% of them released by fish hatcheries. The Terns had concentrated at Rice Island due to the loss of the sandy predator-free islands and beaches they need to breed in the Pacific Northwest. After being ignored over the years in calling for an EIS, Seattle Audubon, the American Bird Conservancy, the National Audubon Society, and Defenders of Wildlife sued last year to require the Army Corps and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to complete a comprehensive EIS before continuing to extirpate terns from breeding islands in the Columbia River. This ruling is a victory not only for Caspian terns and cormorants, but also for the endangered Pacific salmon, said Helen Ross, Conservation Program Manager for the Seattle Audubon Society. And we want to thank Environmental News Service for that story. And the United States is importing $12 million of rare timber cut from the endangered orangutan habitat, a trade that has been banned by Indonesia. An international ban on the export of a rare tree species comes into effect today to help save Indonesia's rapidly disappearing orangutans. The government of Indonesia has banned both the export and domestic trade in ramin, that's Gonostylus banicanus, due to continued illegal logging of this rare and valuable tree species within several of Indonesia's orangutan national parks. The United States is one of the world's largest importers of ramin. Over $12.5 million in ramin were imported from Indonesia last year, and $22 million in total from all countries. Detailed field observations by the Environmental Investigation Agency and Telepak Indonesia have documented massive commercial illegal logging of this species in the world-renowned Tanjung Puting National Park, home to one of the largest remaining populations of the endangered orangutan, Asia's only great ape. Orangutans are highly dependent upon trees for their food, nests, and for moving through the forest. In Tanjung Puting National Park in Kalimantan, where about 500 orangutans survive, massive illegal logging has devastated much of their habitat. Orangutan numbers in the wild have declined by 50% in the last decade, and habitat destruction poses the greatest threat to their survival. Indonesia is home to 80% of the world's remaining orangutans. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news here on Earth First Radio. If you'd like to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com, C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. You can send regular mail letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please send all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And search for Free Radio Santa Cruz to listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so tune in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. And search for Earth First Radio. This is show number, I think it's 153. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to the CD If a Tree Falls. This tune is called Priests of the Golden Bull, and it's by Buffy St. Marie.
brought the bomb wrapped up in business cards and stained with steak. Who hires a maid to wash his money? Who keeps politicians on the take? Who puts outspoken third worlders in jail just to shut them down? Oh, the lies vary from place to place, but the truth is still the same, even in this town. Money junkies all over the world trample us on their way to the bank. They run in every race. Indigo. Third worlders see it first. The dynamite, the dozers, the cancer, and the acid rains. The corporate caterpillars come into our backyards and turn the world to pocket change. Reservations are the nuclear front line. Uranium poisoning kills. We're starving in a handful of gluttons. We're drowning in their gravy spills. Their tongues are silver forks. There's a lack of wisdom. You can hear it on their breath. Delicate confronting these priests to the golden bowl. They preach from the pulpit of the bottom line. Their minds rustle with million-dollar bills. They say silver burns a hole in your pocket. Gold burns a hole in your soul. Uranium burns a hole in forever. It just gets out of control. There was a crooked man who walked a crooked mile. He raised a crooked sixpence to hide a crooked style. He won a crooked vote, and he smiled a crooked smile. Windigo. Their tongues are silver forks. There's a lack of wisdom. You can hear it on their breath.